Hey, hello everyone. Welcome to this live cast. It is Saturday, March 11th. I am here with Evie. Hey, Evie.
Hi, how you doing? Glad to be here.
Oh man, we are, there's a lot going on. So we just had a really big, what I thought was a very important emergency live webinar with our tribe last night. We do that for insiders, for key supporters, two of our membership levels, because we just had to talk about this bank failure. This is actually a really big deal, so we want to just have a chance to talk about this bank failure a little bit more. And as well, we have to talk about this congressional clown show that's going on. This is actually a really big deal to me, because, you know,
it's a good name for it.
I'm a free speech maximalist, absolutist. I really believe that you have the right to say anything you want, and if I have a bad reaction to that, it's up to me to figure out what I'm going to do about that, either own my own reaction, look at myself,
that's
decide
mature.
I don't want anything to do with you anymore or engage with you or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But that's on me. It's not up to you to figure out how to pre-constrain your speech for my benefit. And of course, as you get older and more wise in life, you figure out how to say things in a more appropriate way. And you know how you figure that out? By saying things in a stupid way and getting clocked for that, you know? Hopefully you work that out as a kid, but some of us take longer. So just how it is, right?
It's true.
So I'm a big believer in free speech. So, hey, but this is a live cast, so this is anything that you want to, or if I look down, I'm monitoring your chat right here. If you want to pop a question in, please do. We have slow mode on, so there might be a slight delay, because otherwise they sometimes fly by.
Yeah, it's hard to see.
But we're just going to talk about what is going on out
if
here.
If only someone had warned us about the coming crash.
If only somebody had warned us about the coming crash, says CJ Bartholomew.
We'll have to try this with the...
Something like this crash.
Exactly.
New book. Very happy with that, that it's out. I have the physical copy. All right, let's go there. Let's, you know me, I like to talk with slides. Let's talk about this bank collapse real quick. I'm sure it's on everybody's minds. There's a lot of information flying around out there. I'm going to do what I can to clarify some of it. First off, this is not just another bank failure. This is the second largest U.S. bank failure. Only Washington Mutual in 2008 was larger.
Wow.
We're talking about a bank with over $200 billion in assets. Allegedly, what it had was... So, very quickly, a bank's assets are somebody else's liabilities and vice versa. It's how banking works. The whole, all of banking is just a, it's an accounting sheet. Assets and liabilities, it's the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So my asset is the bank account I have. That's the liability of the bank. The bank's assets would be things like loans it's made, car loans, auto loans, student loans, mortgages, or it owns treasuries, mortgage-backed securities. So anytime a bank has an asset, it's actually somebody else's debt.
Even if that's like, even if it isn't paid back yet, I mean, it's technically an asset that hasn't occurred. Do you know what I'm saying? If you owe money to the bank and you've only paid 2 years on your 30-year mortgage.
Yeah. So, well, some of these loans are what are called secured and some are unsecured. So a secured loan has some collateral behind it, your house. Right? If you don't pay your mortgage, what happens? If you miss your last mortgage payment, number 360 out of 360, right? You've paid 359 of them. You know what happens? You lose your house.
That's awful.
That's how that works.
That's awful.
Right? Yeah.
That's not nice.
Right, Joe Potter? Show me the money. So at any rate, this was the second largest U.S. bank failure here. And this is kind of intriguing because this is... this happened to Silicon Valley out here. This was the backbone of startups and venture capital. I've been hearing from people who have been saying this is a really big deal for in the world of startups. This is going to hit and hit hard because it's even if they clear this up and JP Morgan assumes this bank's assets and it carries on, this is going to send shockwaves through the entire process of startup funding. This is a pretty centralized thing, bank here. So anyway, shockwaves. Shockwaves. Not a surprise, though. We saw it coming. Now, I have to confess, the idea of some Silicon Valley venture funds losing a few bucks doesn't exactly...
Doesn't bother you.
Bother me all that much.
You're not going to lose sleep tonight.
Not really, no. And I'll tell you why. Because Silicon Valley is behind... It's the same crew of people who have been censoring me. who've been censoring everybody. I kind of, maybe rightly or wrongly, but I assign Silicon Valley with names like YouTube and Google and Facebook and Twitter and, right? And these are all companies that have been operating antithetically to everything I consider to be important and valuable about being an American. They've been behaving in ways that are reprehensible. So if somehow that world got a little spanked around now, not gonna lose a lot of sleep. Now here's the fun part. This bank failure, of course, everybody is a gigantic capitalist. When these companies are all raking in money and banks are making money hand over fist, nobody says nothing. That's capitalism. They have a right to make a profit. The minute they get in trouble, ooh, all the libertarians go flying out the window. And next thing you know, everybody's all like, oh, we need a bailout. Let's socialize this right away.
That's true. That's so true. They don't share their profits.
Shoot. Nope. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal. This is a big deal. So this is a shot across the bow. Now, hey, Ryan, why don't you, this is Menlo freaking Park, California. I'm talking like a split level 1950s era ranch in this town is like $2 million.
Uh-huh.
Right?
What is that line? Oh, no.
These
are those
people
trying to take their money?
Just let it loop for a while. These are just people lining up to try and get in to get some of their money back out of SVB. That's the Silicon Valley Bank right there. This is Menlo Park. Normally when you see this bank run stuff, this is like the poor people get hurt. This is a funny place for this to start.
Right.
You know, I'm just optically, that's a funny place for that to start. But that's Menlo freaking Park. This is Wellesley, Mass. Lawrence Leopard here writing, shades of 1930s. This is my bank in Wellesley this morning. Boston Private Bank was recently acquired by Silicon Valley Bank. Porsche. When you see the Porsches lined up outside the bank, that's when you know you have a problem.
It's serious.
Right?
It's pretty serious. Wow.
Yeah.
In Massachusetts, too.
Yeah.
I mean, this is going to be probably a cascade effect over time, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Oceana 23, there is a place called Menlo Freaking Park, but the freaking, it's capitalized. Menlo Freaking.
I was going to ask about that.
Let's see here. Mike Miko Dem asking, hey, Chris, is SVB crash the real start of the collapse, or do we have to wait some more? No, this is your warning. This is your warning shot right here. It may go calm after this for a little while and even seem to recover. The Fed's going to have to decide one of two courses of action from here. Keep hiking and wait for more accidents like this to play out, or pivot. Either way, it's not a good sign in this particular story. If we understand the genesis of this, though, this isn't just some stupid bank doing some stupid things, which it is. It's more than that. This happened because the Federal Reserve did really dumb stuff in 87, 94, 1998, 2001, 2006, 7, 8, and then 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 19, and then 2020. This is just increasingly dumb stuff by the Fed. So these poor banks, these regional banks, this is really a story of a regional bank more than a money center bank or a biggie like Bank of America or JP Morgan. This is a story of small banks that were having to figure out what to do with when, so if you deposit money and the bank is going to hold reserves, what does it do with that? Well, it makes loans, but otherwise it's going to take those reserves and it's going to park them in some kind of an interest-bearing asset. So at the time that these banks were trying to figure out what to do, and this includes a lot of regional banks, there's a big list of them, what they were doing was they were having to invest in 10-year treasuries that were yielding a half a freaking percent. Okay? Half a freaking percent. You can't run a business on that if you're a bank, because banks live on the big between what they pay out, cheap deposits, and then loans. But part of that is they have to put their money into something, right? So that started to happen. And then this has been really bad for banks because, well, people are doing what I'm doing. I can hold my money at Treasury Direct with the U.S. Treasury itself, skip the bank entirely, and earn 5% when my bank can maybe offer 2, 3, sometimes 4% if you tie your money up for a long time in a CD,
right,
something like that. Who cares? No, I'd rather get 5%. So, but this was Boston. This was Boston. You know what? I have an explanation for why Boston got struck, and it's because, well, It's because they erected a statue honoring the sweet potato, and obviously they pissed off the other vegetable gods. The rutabaga god.
This makes me blush. I don't know why this statue. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
The sweet potato was the kindest thing I could call that. I was searching, like, make this family friendly. What do you do? That's as close as I could get.
Yep, it does look like that. That's fair.
All right, so let's dive in. Let's dive into this a tiny bit. Okay, so the Silicon Valley Bank CEO, right, Greg Becker, right? He was on the San Francisco Fed's board.
Okay.
So this whole idea that the Federal Reserve, first off, the Fed caused this by keeping interest rates too low. They knew they were crushing these banks. They have the CEO serving on the board with the Federal Reserve in the district, in the region, because there's 12 Federal Reserve districts. He's on the San Francisco district. Greg Becker is sitting there on the board. He's a Class A director. They have Class A, B, C. He's a Class A director. There's not a chance in the world that the Federal Reserve wasn't aware of the sort of pain and pressure that they were putting these banks under. In fact, this guy was voting for this kind of stuff and providing feedback to put this stuff. But look at this. I love it. These guys, when they're really embarrassed, they move at the speed of lightning. He was on the bank until Friday. That's when the bank collapsed. But they got him off. I went to their website. He scrubbed. They scrubbed him. I had to
already?
Use, yeah, gone.
Wow.
Just as if it never happened. I had to use the Wayback Machine, and I found him. So here he is. Yep, 2019. I had to go back a little bit. Sure enough, Greg Becker has been elected to the head office Class A director. Prior to becoming CEO of SVB, Mr. Becker worked as the bank president's COO, the chief operations officer.
Wow. Is that that's a legal world, thing to do?
Clown world rating from me.
Yeah, right.
This is total clown world time. There he is. Nice looking guy. Looks not, I mean, just, why wouldn't run into him on the street, wouldn't think anything bad or any of that stuff. Not saying he's necessarily a bad guy, but so when you become the CEO
of interest, though, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Isn't that a conflict of interest to do that? I mean,
it seems all a of banking and regulation in DC is one giant ball of conflict of interest.
Okay.
So he fit right into that.
Good.
That's just why it's clown world to me. It's like, really? Right. Same guy as Lehman, says Joe Potter. Come on. That's crazy talk, Joe. He wouldn't. Oh, yeah, actually, he did. Who did he hire in as his chief administrative officer of SVB Securities was the CFO for Lehman Brothers, Mr. Gentile. What could go wrong? How could this possibly have happened?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, this is just. So, of course, Lehman Brothers was the big bank that collapsed. This guy's got just his resume now is just a little bit in tatters. So, Joe, let's see. So, you've been working at Lehman Brothers, then SVB. And
poor guy.
I tell you what.
He'll be at McDonald's.
I'm kind of hoping he goes to work for JP Morgan. Oh, this is just crazy time. Crazy time. So, but get this. So this whole bank collapses on March 10th. So I have a little timeline. You know me, I'm kind of an investigative reporter. We were just talking about that this morning, right? I'm just sort of I'm a little bit of a hound when it comes to this stuff.
You are a journalist. Myself. You are.
A little bit.
Unofficially.
I like digging for stuff. And we don't have any advertisers, so I don't care about anything. I'm like, I'll piss off everybody. It doesn't matter. But check this out. Robert Hanna pulled this out remember, this thing collapses on March 10th. Greg Becker sold 11% of his shares, millions of dollars of shares in this company when it was trading at about $250 a share here on February 27th. Michael Zucker, general counsel, 19% on February 5th. Daniel Beck, the CFO, clocks out a hefty 32% of his total ownership of shares on February 27th. Michelle Draper, the CMO, sold 25% of her shares on February 1st. I guarantee you there's not a chance that they suddenly had a run on this bank on March 9th and it collapsed on the 10th. They knew about this stuff. So, this is such a clown world. I decided to go efficient. Remember, I had to show you as two a double icon set. I went for the efficiency here, and I combined them into a single icon. It's faster. I like efficiency.
That's awesome. You should copyright that.
Yes, Pelosi level prescience, writes Brandon Rutter there. We just got lucky. Look at all these lucky people just ringing the cash register and selling out millions of dollars of shares right before the collapse. And how many of us here honestly think there's going to be any consequence for them besides getting a better job, maybe working in the Congressional Budget Office?
Exactly. Maybe. All right, so we won't know basically what happened for a while, right? Like when they go to unravel, like what actually occurred that caused the bank to fail.
Yeah.
We won't know.
No, it's going to take a little while. But wait. It gets worse. So all of these people cash out basically in early to late February. So it's called February. February, the ring in the cash register, okay. Right? What happens on it just a touch later? So Andrew Purdy here writing, the CEO of SIVB also served as the San Francisco Fed till last week. Tell me that the powers that be didn't have full knowledge of what was going on. Good observation. But check this out. SVB also tried to raise $3.7 billion from investors. They did a filing with the SEC, which I checked down, and he's absolutely right. They did on March 2nd.
Oh no.
Yeah.
That's
they tried to they, like
sounds sketchy.
They dump a bunch of shares and then go for a capital raise. Cuz you know when you try and go for a capital raise, the whole market squints, gives you side eye and says, "What's going on?" And then the shares will fall in price. So they rang the cash register and then they tried to raise $3.7 billion and then the whole thing just a week later is toast, is done.
Wow.
Boom. Right? This is that's just nuts. Like FTX. There's this huge scandal. Mm-hmm. It's massive. It's allowed to happen. Nobody seems to know what to do or say anything about it. And it's just crazy. Mr. Thompson there, thank you for the 5 pounds in the clown world. It is clown world. It's just total clown world. It really is. So quick aside. Hey, thank you, everybody. Thank you. This book here. Thank you, everybody who heeded the call and bought a pre-order copy, because the Crash Course made it to the bestseller list on the Wall Street Journal.
Yay!
There was much rejoicing. So we're pretty happy with that. Because we thought maybe if we were lucky, we were going to crack it. But number six. That's pretty cool. Look, we bumped out.
How does that feel?
That feels really good.
I know you worked really hard to get that out.
Yeah, did you read the acknowledgments?
You'll make me cry. They're very sweet.
Yeah. So thanks for that. And by the way, so that means we have a new cover on the way. Look at that. Look at that little red banner at the top now.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I'm excited because this means that more people are going to find out about it, maybe who didn't know. But so if you want to understand what's really going on with this whole banking scandal and why I'm just sort of permanently bearish in the sense that I don't believe there's any long-term solution to where we're going in this particular story is because I understand what's happening with energy and the economy and how those two relate to each other and how they relate also to the environment with an honorary fourth E in the story, which is exponential growth. And that's what this book, this is the revised edition, it first came out in 2011, is a book. But if you understand what's in that book, all of this other stuff that's happening, if you think the SVB failure is a big deal, wait till all the banks fail. Because that's where we're headed, because we have inept, corrupt leadership in its clown world. The only way we could not experience a really bad outcome here in terms of like things sort of not working well and collapsing even, is if we had non-clown world leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So, abandon all hope, ye who enter the second part of this presentation.
Aw, man.
Well, let's go there.
It's a weekend.
Let's go there. Let's go to Jay Powell himself. Jay, clue us in. How's our future looking?
This is not about what the Fed has done. This is what about the Congress has done that you have to factor in to your decisions. Do you think about the costs of borrowing for the United States itself?
No, we do not, and we're not going to. In other words, that would be fiscal dominance. If we were, you know, constrained in our monetary policy by the budgetary situation of the United States, and we're not, we're clearly not. The path we're on is not sustainable, but the level of debt that we have is not unsustainable, is sustainable, put it that way. Wait. So we don't think about interest costs when we make monetary policy. We think about maximum employment and price stability.
It's your opinion that the level of debt we have is sustainable?
Yes. I mean, we have the, you know, the largest economy in the world. We can service this debt. That's not the problem. The problem is that we're on a path where the debt is growing substantially faster than the economy. And that's kind of by definition in the long run unsustainable. And the way countries have fixed that is with longer term programs that have bipartisan support and that address the actual problem in the budget. That's really the formula.
All right. What he just said is, she's like, Mr. Powell, the government, the United States, has just fallen out of a plane without a parachute. Is this going to be deadly? He goes, no, it's totally survivable. I mean, the path we're on doesn't end well, but currently there's no particular problem. So the level of debt we have, he's right, is not unsustainable in the sense that we could roll over this level of $31 trillion and sort of work it off over time if we wanted to. But we can't because the U.S. government is fiscal deficit spending about 6% of GDP. So if they stopped taking more debt on, they would immediately tank the economy by 6%, which would then knock-on effect actually tank it by 10%, which would actually tank the whole thing. The U.S. government is caught on a path. That's what he left out, is like the government, U.S. government cannot get off its current path without crashing the system. But the alternative is to stay on the path which crashes the system. That's the bind, right? So that's why he was stammering. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's not, no, it's not, it's not. It's not that it's not unsustainable. It's that it's not understood, you know, stammering mess. That's the guy who's responsible for this mess. Janet Yellen, responsible for this mess. Ben Bernanke, responsible for this mess. Alan Greenspan, it was just a quadruple, it was like Larry Curly Moe and an honorary, like, Bozo, the clown, right? It's like, that's been our leadership.
I love those guys.
It's just one giant policy error after another, and so here we are. Here we are with $92 trillion of debt, $200 trillion of unfunded liabilities, and no path to get forward except we're going to grow really fast. Oh, really? How are we going to grow, Batman? Right? Mm. What's going to happen there? Oh, Teague, thank you very much saying here, just skimmed through your book, Chris. I'm disappointed there isn't a chapter on how to land a babe. Thanks again for all your insight. It's contained in the intro. The acknowledgments.
It's true.
Secrets are all in there.
I'm blushing again.
but that's this whole SVB. Yes, this is a shot across the bow. Mm-hmm. Yes, you should be. You should have a lot. Where you have your money stored is very important. The FDIC. Let me be absolutely clear about this. The FDIC does not have sufficient reserves. If we had a giant contagious bank run, meaning lots of people got nervous, started pulling their money out of banks. The banks, did you ever see the movie It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. I like that one.
Yeah, it's got a nice deep moral, but remember the bank scene, right? All the people come in, yeah. They want their bank back. They're trying to explain back there in whatever they shot that movie in, whatever that was, the 40s or something, about how fractional reserve banking works. Mm-hmm. Fractional reserve banking. So 100% reserve banking would be, I give you $100 to hold for me, and it's in your wallet next week when I ask for it. Mm-hmm. Fractional reserve EV lending banking would be 10 people give you $100, you spend nine of those $100, and you keep one because you know that on average only one out of 10 people is going to ask for that back. So you keep a fraction in reserve just in case people ask for it. If 100% of people, well, not even 100%, if a few percent of people who have their money deposited in a bank go and try and pull it out, the bank doesn't have it. It's just like that scene in It's a Wonderful Life. Well, I don't have your money, right? Maybe it's in her house and it's in his property. And
exactly. Right?
That's how the system works.
People are asking, by the way, should they take their money out?
So if you don't get the book, though, This is an online course as well. The first third of this is called The Economy. I talk about how the money system works, because if you don't understand the system of money and how banking works, none of this makes sense. But it's not that hard to understand. And here's the weird thing. I've taught this many, many times over the years. I have asked in audiences probably close to 10,000 people by now over time, because I usually ask this question when I have a large audience. How many of you were taught how money is created in the system of banking? It's not a hard thing to teach. I've taught fifth graders, sixth graders. It's the mind boggles because you're like, that can't be how it is, but it's not hard to explain. It's hard to absorb. It's not hard to understand. It's hard to accept, right? Out of that whole time, only two hands have gone up.
Let's ask our folks, share with us in the chat if you've ever been taught about that.
Good idea. Yeah. Hey, so just tuck it down in the chat. Were you ever taught how banking actually creates money in the system is a normal part of your education, either at high school, college, wherever? Was that ever part of it? So see what comes up there. But again, it's a very, very rare thing. One person had a Marxist professor at Oberlin, and another one had a Marxist professor at UMass of economics who taught them, you know, that stuff. So yeah, catastrophic New England. Hey, good to see you again. Yeah, it's literally a confidence game. So the whole system works as long as everybody has confidence. This is the important part. SIVB was a break in confidence. And it doesn't give me confidence to see Jay Powell stammer through like, well, it's not technical. It's only unsustainable if we keep doing it like it's been operating for the past 30 years.
It's safe and effective.
It's fine.
Don't worry.
As long as we don't keep doing what we've been doing for 30 years. Not in school, Mike Maloney. I am for I am says yes. That'd be interesting. Say more. No, I had to pull back the curtain on my own, says Ponzi Zombie Killer. No one ever taught me.
Learned.
No.
Homeschool.
Homeschool will do it. Yep. Nope.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah. So there it is. It's very rare. But there's a reason for that. They don't want you to know that. It's not hard to teach. It's really not. You give me about 5 minutes and a whiteboard, I can explain the process. And it's really bizarre. But the process basically, in a shorthand, would work like this. Let's say, Evie, there's no money in the world.
Okay.
But we're going to start the system of banking as it's configured. Mm-hmm. So I'm the Federal Reserve. I'm just going to give you $1,000. That's called base money. Here's $1,000. There's now $1,000 in the world. That's all there is. And you're like, I better put this in a bank. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm a bank too. So now you put your $1,000 in the bank, and on this asset liability side, you have $1,000 asset. Mm-hmm. I have $1,000 liability because I owe you that $1,000. Mm-hmm. But I'm a bank. So I'm like, I don't have to keep all this because the rules allow me to only keep 10% in reserve. So then I loan out $900 of your money. You still have your $1,000 is still sitting there. So I take that $900 and I loan it to some other person, right? Mm-hmm. To, I don't know, buy something, right? So they take that $900. Let's say they pay a carpenter to do some work in their kitchen. Mm-hmm. The carpenter then puts it in the bank, same bank. Your $1,000 is in the bank. Now the carpenter's $900 is in the bank. Hmm. Well, I can loan out 90% of that too. So that's $810. And I loan that to a third person. And when you do all of this, a 10% reserve ratio means that original $1,000 in the bank can be turned into $10,000 of loans. That's fine. That creates activity. People do things. It's all wonderful. The problem is if all $10,000 of people come and say, I want my money, there's still only that original $1,000 in the system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist. Right. So the whole thing just has to keep going. That's how the system works. It is a confidence game, but it has to keep going. And so because of that, we can take a snapshot at any point in time. I could take you to the Federal Reserve database called Fred at St. Louis Federal Reserve. That's one of the districts. Great website. Use it all the time. Glad they have it. And I could show you, we could pull up two things. How much money is in the banking system today? That's a number, right? It's about $22 trillion. Next question, how much debt is in the system? Well, that's about $92 trillion. So there's more debt than money. So if all these people who had these debts had to pay them back, there's a call on it. We're like, sorry, you got to pay your mortgage back tomorrow. All these people would scramble for dollars and there wouldn't be enough because it would be one-fifth as many as needed. So the whole thing has to keep going. The problem is the debt if you follow how the system is constructed, the debt is always growing exponentially faster than the money. And so when Jay Powell says it's not sustainable, what he really needs to say is the way we constructed our debt-based money system is fundamentally not sustainable. Mm-hmm. It has to grow exponentially forever, and then it blows up eventually someday. So that's what Jay Powell is saying here.
Translation.
It's unsustainable. But what he really needs to understand is that that the whole system of banking, the system itself, has a date with a lot of trouble at some point. So T saying no. Can you scroll back down for that one?
Yeah, I'll try.
Yeah. Sparkuri says, no, we weren't taught. Please see message you on Peak Prosperity. It's regarding this opportunity in time to propose curriculum. I'd like to hear more about that. So I'll check the message on Peak Prosperity. Because people need to know this stuff. I mean, that's what I do. I'm an educator. I'm a sleuth, information scout. But I think if people understood these things, then there's power in that and freedom. We can argue and we can bitch all we want about, oh, well, yeah, it's a rigged system. And it is totally rigged system. You are not wrong. However, it doesn't do any good to simply note it's rigged. It's rigged, but it's got rules. As soon as we learn the rules, we're now in a position to actually figure out how not to be a victim of that game, mm-hmm. right? Just helps. But speaking of, what hope do we have in carrying forward in this? Let's carry on.
Oh man.
So this is Representative Sylvia Garcia. She's Democrat out of Texas, I believe the Houston area. Here she is. She's grilling Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger, who are two journalists who released or were in charge of figuring out how to communicate what was going on with the Twitter files that were released out of Twitter. So here she is. Let's listen in to this esteemed colleague of ours here ask for something that really shouldn't ever be asked for.
By a friend, Barry Weiss.
My friend Barry Weiss.
So this friend works for Twitter, or what is her?
She's a journalist.
Sir, I didn't ask you a question. I'm now asking Mr. Schellenberger a question.
Please, yes, ma'am. Barry Weiss is a journalist.
I'm sorry, sir.
She's a journalist.
She's a journalist. So you work in concert with her?
Yeah.
Do you know when she first was contacted by Mr. Musk?
I don't know.
You don't know. So you're in this as a threesome?
There was many more people involved than that.
There was many more people involved with it. Are you being paid to be here today, either through consulting fees,
no,
campaign contribution
absolutely
to your next
not
run?
Gentle ladies,
absolutely
time
you have
is
an interview
ladies
scheduled after
time
this
is
hearing?
Expired.
Absolutely not.
Gentle
absolutely
ladies, time has expired.
Thank you.
I don't know what to say other than I'll recognize the gentleman from North Dakota for 5 minutes.
I don't
thank
know
you,
what to
Mr.
say.
Chairman, and I'll yield my 5 minutes.
Oh man. So you were some kind of a threesome, huh? First thing that comes to your mind, obviously, Michael Schellenberger did a great job dodging that, saying actually there were many people. So she missed her opportunity to say foursome or orgy. She could have carried that line of thinking questioning.
That's
on.
That's true.
But the inappropriate thing here is, so she's digging around trying to figure out sources. I might have put them out of order, Ryan, but do we have the one where she's asking for sources? Let's see if we have that one.
Yes.
I thank the gentlelady for yielding. I just think this is interesting. First, the FTC is asking for your background. And now the ranking member of the Committee on the Weaponization of Government is asking for your sources.
If I never asked them for their sources.
Yes,
I
did
not ask for sources. Who gave you access to these emails? Who was the individual that gave you permission to access the emails?
Well, the attribution from my story is sources at Twitter, and that's what I'm going to refer to.
Okay. Did Mr. Musk contact you, Mr. Taibbi?
Again, the attribution from my story is sources at Twitter.
So she just asked who gave you this information, which is called asking for sources. And this is part of the clown world we live in, where words don't mean anything anymore, right? You should be able to, she said, she heard when Jim Jordan said the ranking member of the Government Abuse Committee or whatever it's called is asking journalists for their sources, not once, but twice. And also, I think I must have not included it, but Representative Sylvia Garcia also three times asked, tried to get these guys to reveal their sources, right? And tried to be clever because, you know, there's like all kinds of stuff going on where she said, okay, if you won't tell me who gave you the sources, what day did Mr. Musk contact you? She thought she was being clever, right? So here are people, Congress critters, openly asking for the sources of journalists, not once, not twice, three times, four times, five times in this hearing. And then just play the beginning of that again with Jim Jordan, please, Ryan, because listen to this bald face, just unbelievable lying that's going on here.
Yes. I thank the gentlelady for yielding. I just think this is interesting. First, the FTC is asking for your background, and now the ranking member of the Committee on the Weaponization of Government is asking for your sources.
If I never asked them for their sources.
Yes,
I did not ask for sources. Who gave you?
I never asked for their sources. Yes, you did. You just, we can't even use words. We don't share language anymore. How is this even a thing? We don't.
I don't know. I'm sorry. Like, I'm still. Yeah. I still feel mirth about that. I'm trying to feel serious here.
All right. So to the point here. So every single Democrat, including a horrid, horrid display by Debbie Wasserman Schmidt, and I think I've got something here by Dan Goldman. He's just awful. Every one of them is just trying to impugn the integrity. Wasserman is saying just she took her whole time to go, well, Mr. Taibbi, isn't it true that you made money, more money now from being a journalist now that you broke a huge story, you know?
And your followers
have increased. And she's outraged that she's trying to label him a grifter, which is an interesting thing because she is the ultimate grifter. It's really atrocious. Not one Democrat or commission, FTC, et cetera, dared to ask them about what they found. So can we just talk about what they found real quick? And oh, by the way, right before I jump into that, hey, everybody, you are cordially invited to become members at Peak Prosperity. I sent out, if you'll notice, before we talked about, this is a replay of this collapse. So we had a big, as I mentioned, a webinar last night with our followers talking about this. They're asking us a bunch of questions. Here on March 7th, my spidey senses were jangling and I sent out an alert. I very rarely send out alerts, but it's basically, an alert is when Evie and I are, you know, we come into contact with information that makes us go, uh-oh, we better go to the bank or we better go to the store or do something, right? So it's information that activates us personally to dial in our preparation efforts. So we just sent that out on the 7th because I'd felt like we were just, something was about to hit. And I didn't know it was going to be SVB, but to somebody else's question earlier, this is the beginning of a very big change in trend. Things are going to get interesting from here on out, no question. Now, this most recent Twittergate stuff, March 9th, here you see, so Taibbi dropped these bombshells right before they headed off to give their testimony on that. All those testimony was on the 9th as well. So look at this. Look at this. They said here they're going to monitor all tweets coming from Trump's personal account. In Biden's personal account. So he wrote here, when Twitter files reporters were given access to Twitter internal documents last year, we first focused on the company, which acted like a power above government. So here's a company that's going to be monitoring the private tweets even and messages of presidents. You would think somehow there ought to be like some...
That's weird.
Some level of like, nah... You know, maybe we shouldn't do that. Didn't matter. they did that, right? And of course, they were very clear, like they wanted to get rid of Trump. That's what they wanted to do. So that's bad. You know what's worse? But it actually turns out that Twitter was more like a partner to the government with other tech firms, with all these other tech firms, which is why I'm not at all unhappy that Silicon Valley's about to take a few in the shorts because they deserve it good and hard. They held regular industry meetings with the FBI, with the Department of Homeland Security. They developed a formal system for receiving thousands of content reports from every corner of the government, Health and Human Services, Treasury, the NSA, even local police just meeting after meeting after meeting, thousands of files. Thousands of files. Routine. This is ordinary part of business. Get this. Emails from the FBI, DHS, other agencies often came with spreadsheets of hundreds of thousands of account names for review. And they would delete them soon after.
Ooh, they're covering it up too?
Oh, yeah. Of course, cover-ups. Man. It's not really a good, it's not saucy until you get to the cover-up, right?
Ugh.
This is what every congressperson, I don't care what political party you come from, this is what they should have been focusing on and saying, this is unacceptable, un-American, full stop,
mm-hmm.
you know, subpoenas, we're not grilling Matt Taibbi over this. He's sitting behind us as our star witness. We're grilling the head of the FBI, DHS, none of these people should have been doing any of this stuff.
No.
Full stop, period.
Are they investigating themselves in this story?
No, never.
Of course.
Never, right? So, let me go down one more because it gets worse. So, but that's just the government agencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we came to think of this grouping, the state agencies like DHS, FBI, or the Global Engagement Center, along with NGOs that aren't academic. Non-governmental organizations that aren't academic, and an unexpectedly aggressive partner, which is commercial news media, as the censorship industrial complex.
What?
It was like a huge thing. It wasn't just like, well, you know, a couple of FBI agents went a little rogue.
Right.
What they uncovered was how deep and entrenched and systematic this was. And we knew this. We knew this to be the case. Remember when we were getting canceled for saying Dwizabin, which is horse's paste, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we couldn't mention HCQ once upon a time, when we couldn't talk about that, we just couldn't talk
when
about
you
things.
Got in trouble.
Right? Got in trouble for that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out there was another thing that was even worse than this, which I can't even talk about now because it's still a sore spot in most of these media channels here, which is about the name of the country that's involved in that war over there.
Mm.
You can't talk about that. They were very not. They censored that hard. So who's in the censorship industrial complex? He writes here, Twitter in 2020 helpfully compiled a list. The National Endowment for Democracy. They should rename themselves for Ironic Failures. National Endowment for Ironically Failing. Task failed successfully. National Endowment for Democracy. I don't think they're familiar with this word. I do not think it means what you think it means. Atlantic Council's DFR Lab. Hamilton 68. Which was just a spook fest, the whole thing. It's just stocked full of, like, nasty, awful people. And Alliance for Securing Democracy. Here's a rule. Whatever they name these things, it's the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
The Freedom Center. It's actually probably about locking you down. Right?
That's a good point. That's a good
just
point.
How it is. So, I love naming names, though, so let's go there. Michael Schellenberger just dropped this on March 10th. Saying, here's a list of the journalists and organizations that allowed themselves to be programmed into violating the Pentagon Papers principle. Think twice before trusting them. Let me zoom in on this. This is at the Aspen Institute. I used to love the Aspen Institute. This place is now garbage to me. They ruined and trashed their name. This is the place, the Aspen Institute, where during a three-week window of every year, they invite the world's leading physicists,
mm-hmm.
and they have this amazing confab, and more physics gets done in advance in those 3 weeks than the whole rest of the year.
I remember hearing about that.
It's amazing.
It
was.
Used to be amazing.
Now it's turned into a complete crap show, and it's total garbage. But no surprise. You won't be surprised by this, Evie. Look, Jessica from Director of Policy at Reddit. You know, you realize how, you remember how, just how crazily stupid Reddit became?
Yeah, I do.
Like, our world news, our all, our news, our everything just became, you couldn't say anything about the magic holy shots,
mm-hmm.
right? You couldn't,
mm-hmm.
like, it's just a hive mind now.
It is.
It's just
got banned.
A corporate enforced hive mind. And I'm sure Jessica thinks of herself as a good person trying to do good things in the world, but she is a complete hack. You should never trust her again. Awful, terrible human being in terms of being a productive member of society, or at least deeply anti-American and maybe should go work somewhere where people do not value the things that made this country great, which
mm-hmm.
is private property, freedom of expression, all of that. Olga from Facebook. John Bennett from Wikimedia. Remember my Wikipedia page got taken down on February 5th, 2020?
when you're trying John to get information out there that would be helpful to people.
Yes, because probably early in the whole pandemic, John was having meetings with important security people and saying, how are we going to control the information, right? NBC News, no surprise, right? Just awful, nasty people here. CNN, no surprise. No surprise. No surprise. Facebook again here.
Cybersecurity.
Aspen Institute. You guys suck now. Stanford Cyber Policy Center. Yeah, sorry about that. That's terrible. The Dispatch. Lawfare.
Well, just to clarify, though, I do believe that there are sketchy things that go on the internet. You know, like I don't want them baiting my children or, you know, something like that. I think that it's good to make sure there are things in place that keep kids safe on the internet, because I know there are some schemes out there that are pretty yucky. You know, they'll hack your photographs, and then if this is a child, and they'll say, I'm going to, you know, show them to your whole school unless you send me more.
Well, this is a good point.
Know, weird stuff. So
this
I'm
is
just,
a good point.
Just saying.
So when Elon Musk took over Twitter, he did two things which really pissed off some people. One, he allowed free speech again, which was a big no-no, sent all these people into a giant tizzy. They all said, we're going to Mastodon, an alternative service. And they all stomped over and then quietly came back because there was nothing happening over there. The second thing he did is he found 10 million hours of child porn, which Twitter had been doing nothing about. Nothing. I did a whole episode on that. It's really gross, where there was specific cases where people who were victims, who were known victims, who had certified I'm the person in that video, tried to get specific videos taken down, and they were denied because they said these don't violate Twitter's terms of service or policies. Wow. By the same people who were busy saying, we're going to cancel and take this. If you mentioned natural immunity, you got shut down. If you mentioned vitamin D, you got shut down. Child porn, totally fine. So this is just to show you that this had nothing to do with what you're saying, which is how do we get together to begin to make the world a better place by trying to protect innocent people like children? That's okay. I could rally around that. But in terms of normal people having full informed consent, I'm going to show you what that means in just a second. So let me finish this piece because it's a great point. The Poynter Institute, which is the ones who do all the fact checking. Remember? So when I fact check the fact checkers, that comes through the Poynter Institute. So sorry, Kelly McBride, you work at a crap job and you can't be proud of it. And there's nothing there that's important that you're doing. New York Times, of course. Washington Post, of course. New Yorker, of course. More CNN, makes sense. NPR. How do you feel about NPR, Evie?
Oh, I can't stand it. I hate NPR.
You do?
Yeah.
Well, I found this, so I haven't exposed you to this yet. I found a meme yesterday that's
you
just
did.
For you. Yeah. Ready? It'll come up any second now.
That's funny. I've been seeing that logo all my life.
I know. I hadn't made that connection before.
That's awesome.
PBS, NPC.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say. All right. I don't. Carrying on.
Thank
of course, Yoel Roth here of Twitter, just a nasty, horrible human being there. The member of Facebook's oversight board. New York Times again. Daily Beast. Aspen Institute again, shaming itself. First Draft News here. Google, naturally. And Stanford again. There's certain names that just show up over and over again. You know. But these are all the people who got together very excitedly. So so you have your DHS, FBI, et cetera, doing their government thing. But then these are all the people who they feel important because, you know, I'm working with the FBI and we're trying to keep the world safe from misinformation, malinformation, disinformation, all of which are euphemisms or metaphors for stuff that makes us embarrassed.
Mm-hmm. Uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
Don't agree with.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but back to your point. Let's talk about what were they doing on these things in order to keep the world a safer place? And this one really shocked me. So this came out from what they found. They found that they had labeled something that had to be blocked as the output of this committee's meetings.
Okay.
They said it's important that we block true content which might promote vaccine hesitancy. This could include stories of true vaccine side effects. The content is not clearly mis- or disinformation, but it may be malinformation in the sense that it causes things to happen that we wouldn't want to happen, which is, you know, things that might cause vaccine hesitancy. Also included in this bucket are often true posts, which could fuel vaccine hesitancy.
So, like, that's why they took down, they say it's rare.
Yep.
Remember that?
All those accounts that got taken down.
Oh, no.
All these people who tried to organize and got gaslit, and, like, the people who were injured forming a group, and the group would get taken down. And I heard about probably 5 or 6 very large Facebook groups where thousands of people would get together, mm-hmm. and then the group would disappear because Facebook would take it down based on this policy, which was they didn't care if it was true or not. They didn't care if you had an actual injury that you, or a side effect that you wanted to talk with other people about. That was not allowed, because somehow when you get a, you know, if you get one person can be dumb, but 10 people can be ridiculously stupid. So when you get, like, can you imagine how just dumb it got with this many people in the room, goal seeking, all attempting to be a little bit more woke and virtue signally than the next person, and the line is a little slippery and they don't have any morals or ethics to their name, and so they just sit there quietly while they all adopt a policy that basically says, yeah, you know what, we should shit can people who dare mm-hmm. to talk about their personal experience in life.
Mm-hmm.
This includes Eric Clapton. He was vaccine injured. Remember,
that's
his
right,
hands
yeah.
didn't work. One of the most famous
Nobody
guitarists
cares.
Of all time.
Nobody cares.
Nobody cares. Right?
That's
no, this is horrifying. So seeing it all spun out like this, right? This is horrifying. And one more time. One more time, Ryan. Let's just hear how the Democratic leadership decided to go at this after being exposed to this level of horrifying behavior. Here's the question.
Led by a friend, Barry Weiss?
My friend, Barry Weiss.
So this friend works for Twitter, or what is her...
She's a journalist.
Sir, I didn't ask you a question. I'm now asking Mr. Schellenberger a question.
Please, yes, ma'am. Barry Weiss is a journalist.
I'm sorry, sir?
She's a journalist.
She's a journalist. So you work in concert with her?
Yeah.
Do you know when she first was contacted by Mr. Musk?
I don't know.
You don't know. So you're in this as a threesome?
There was many more people involved than that.
There was many more people involved with it. Are you being paid to be here today, either through consulting fees,
no,
campaign contribution
absolutely
to your
not.
Next run?
Gentle
absolutely
ladies,
do you have an interview
gentle
scheduled
ladies,
after
time
this
has
hearing?
Expired.
Absolutely not.
Gentle
absolutely.
Ladies, time Thank has you. Expired.
Thank you.
I don't know what to say other than I recognize the gentleman from North Dakota for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr.
He's
Chairman.
Like, he's like, I don't even know what to say. Are you being paid to be here? That is the most ignorant, reprehensible, dishonorable, unethical sort of a series of questions you could possibly ask in response to this kind of information. This should have raised alarm bells, and instead all she's trying to do is get some dirt. Are you getting paid for this? Were you having threesomes? Who are your sources? Right? I can't even believe this lady can get out of her car on her own, right? Where's the handle? You know? But more to the point, these are the people who are in charge, and we're about to experience a massive bank failure, financial crisis. But good news, these people are on the job. Are going to lead you through this whole piece, which is why Evie and I say panic early, panic often. Make sure you have plenty of, since it's turned into something of a drinking game on the last episode, plant a garden. I've heard that some of you have to take a shot now. So I would never say plant a garden 3 times, because if I said plant a garden like that and you guys were just taking shots, plant a garden. Well, there now. See, your day's shot. It's all over.
Yeah, but they could be planting a garden on on whatever it is, drink of their choice.
Like, well, we're almost at spring here, so we are getting ready to plant our garden. seriously.
Gardening on.
What have we done? We've taken cash out of the bank. We have. Obviously, gold and silver. It are somewhere within our ability to lay our hands on it. We bought toilet paper, of course. And we live on our solution, such as it is we live here on a farmette, right? So we got cows and chickens and a garden and all that. But I do think it's time to understand that things are going to get dicier as we go forward. And we are going to experience greater and greater levels of disruptions that are going to come forward. So do we have any more chats going
on?
Or
what's going on? It's disconnected over
okay.
here.
Well, great. So Evgeny Zizlis is asking, can you explain the FAS 157 rule that has not been reinstated back for smaller banks, the mark-to-market rule? SVB 200 billion in securities actually worth 16 billion mark-to-market. Now, I don't think they're worth 16 billion mark-to-market. Let me see if I can. Oh, that was on yesterday's presentation. I might not be able to pull that up in time. Let me see. It should be no, probably not going to be able to open that up in time. What we have going on is that so the problem was for all of the banks that were forced into buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities back during the 0% interest era, right? When the Federal Reserve in its infinite wisdom got a bunch of people together and said, maybe we should control the price of money and the quantity. They try to do two things at once, you can't. So they were busy trying to control the price of money, and they did, and they said the price of money is zero. Okay, well, so the problem with that is if you own a bond, let's say you have $1 billion of bonds, and they're paying 0.5, let's say make it easy, they're paying 1%. And then all of a sudden, that's okay. Your balance sheet says you have $1 billion of bonds paying 1% rate of interest, but then interest rates go to 4%, right? What just happened? Well, you can't sell these bonds for $1 billion because somebody could pay $1 billion and buy bonds that are paying 4%. So you know what happens? Your bonds are actually worth a lot less. That's called the mark-to-market price. Now, if you could just hold your bonds till they matured, you get your principal back, everything's fine. But if you have to sell them, and that's what happened to SVB, they suddenly had to sell their bonds that were worth, let's say, $1 billion, but now because they had to sell them it all at once in a bad market, those bonds were worth perhaps maybe $800 million or something like that. So the difference between your mark-to-market price and the price that they're held at on your balance sheet, that's the loss in there. So this is an unrealized loss where you're sort of holding them. As soon as you sell them, it's a realized loss. So that's a problem. And so that talking about that 157 rule, this a lot of things happened in the aftermath of 2008. Banks were allowed to do some crazy stuff after that, right? Super crazy. They were allowed to decide through management expertise and guesswork what their derivative portfolios were actually worth. They would record them on the balance sheet at management discretion. They were allowed to hold and claim that their assets were worth what they were when they bought them, not at a mark-to-market price. There were all kinds of crazy things, but probably the craziest of all things that happened, just nuts to me, excuse me, was what happened in 2010 with the City Act, is what I call it, but it's actually, it was a Bank Reform Act, Dodd-Frankie thing. That totally changed the position of a bankruptcy proceeding for a bank. So if a financial institution entered bankruptcy post-2010, it turned out that, you know, there's senior creditors, less senior or subordinate creditors, unsecured creditors, super senior creditors. So in that list, in that subordination list of who gets paid first, let's say a bank goes belly up, it's only worth half what you thought it was worth. Well, these people get paid first and these get second. And if there's anything left, these people get something, but these poor unsecured creditors get the dribs at the last end. This Dodd-Frank Act actually did something unthinkable to me. It elevated the derivative positions, and a derivative is a bet. A bank makes a derivative bet with another bank. That's, you do credit default swap, an interest rate swap, something like that. They're going to do these various bets with each other. Those got elevated to the most senior position in that subordination structure. The most senior, the bets. These hundreds of billions, if not trillions, if not quadrillions of dollars of derivative bets are the first things that get paid out or settled. Then you go into the senior bonds, junior bonds, come down through the equity layer. You know who's last on that list? Depositors. They are unsecured creditors. They go along with, I don't know, let's say the company that ran the janitorial service, they didn't get paid, you know, by this. They're an unsecured creditor, probably. So imagine that. You take your cash, you put it in a bank, and you think, I have an asset there. You do not. If you read the bank documentation carefully and it's thick or fine print when you sign up, you're an unsecured creditor. To me, it was absolutely, that's why I call it the City Act, because Citibank really, or the Chase Act, some people call it, whatever. But big banks desperately wanted their bets to be paid out first. So that's where we're at. So the next question, all those unsecured creditors, if you have more than $250,000 in a bank account, you're not going to get FDIC insured for that above amount. And that above amount would be subject to a bail-in. A bail-out is when public money comes and makes the bank whole. A bail-in is when they just go in and seize your money in bank accounts and then give you something back in exchange for that, usually stock in a very worthless company, right?
Somebody's asking, what about mortgages? Can they demand payment in full?
No. Most mortgages, well, some could, but most mortgages do not have a call provision in it that says you have to pay us right now. Some do, right? Some commercial mortgages, they have that right. There's always call options, but those would be subject to a lot of terms and conditions. So they would normally say, hey, I'm going to loan you all this money. It's for a, you told me it's for a an apartment building, and you told me that it was going to have 85% occupancy. But if it doesn't, we have the right to then something, something, something. That would be a condition. And if you got to 70% occupancy, we might say, no, you have to pay us back, which for that would normally mean you'd have to go out and find another loan somewhere, right? So that could happen. and then there are balloon mortgages where there is a defined repayment schedule, but you owe that balloon payment at a particular moment. All right. Insider here, double Q. One, do we have a way to know what food-related products to avoid from the train accident in Ohio? And two, gas price going up. Thanks. Well, no, you don't have an easy way of knowing. I mean, yes, one easy way is if you live in that region of Ohio, I would not be buying anything from any farms that were straight downwind from that in particular. So the good news is this happened in winter. So this would have been a lot worse if this had landed on hay fields that were growing, pastures that cows were eating off of, vegetables that were currently actively growing, and all of that. Because the vinyl chloride itself breaks down fairly quickly in the atmosphere, has a half-life measured in hours. When they burnt it, they created a little phosgene gas, a lot of hydrogen chloride. Those two things as well break down relatively quickly. What I don't know, because I haven't seen the tox yet, is what all the other stuff was. Because those oily sheens, have you seen people poking the rivers?
It's like bubbling up on the surface.
Yeah, I don't know what that stuff is.
That's a good question. So it is good that it was everything's dormant. I wonder what perennials or, you know, other things might have issues, like if it's a plant that comes back every year.
Yeah, I don't know. So I would want to see, you know, some soil testing and all that, but the part I would be most worried about would be actually just downwind of the place where maybe there was some combustion products that would then settle. The thing I'm most worried about in that circumstance are what are called dioxins. Now, dioxins are a very, very broad class. They're one of the most toxic compounds known to humans.
Oof. Oh, is that the thing you would take? There's a supplement that a friend of ours is taking for that.
To try and get rid of it?
Yeah, in your body.
I don't know. It's tough stuff because it's very fat soluble. It wouldn't be like something you could chelate out of your bloodstream.
No, it's
It'd be hard to get rid of.
What is she taking? Shoot.
Like charcoal?
No. It's a green, algae
the chlorella stuff?
Yeah. I think
that's it. I mean, that's if it's in your gut or something like that already. But this stuff distributes to the fat tissues very, very rapidly.
And then your body just stores it up.
So maybe if you were going through a fat reduction program, that would be a time to be taking that because as your fat's reducing, it might be releasing this stuff. And then you would have a chance of that being found down there somewhere.
Flushing out,
So that's what I would be worried about most is the dioxins. And it's a broad family of compounds. But that was the stuff Agent Orange caused. This is crazy. Agent Orange caused decades of misery in Vietnam. A bunch of servicemen went over and they came back and had babies with with birth defects, and they themselves had cancers and eczema and all, just a huge range of problems. But for the people living there, decades they were still experiencing these acnes that would be all over their body, cancers, birth defects, you name it. And that was because of the dioxin. So they had an area that was maybe 200 square miles, which was really bad. Mm-hmm. And the estimate is that over that 200 square miles, can you imagine an area that big? There was about 300 total pounds of dioxin had accidentally been spread on that. 300 pounds over 200 square miles was enough mess that place up for you know, decades afterwards. So, not good stuff.
Mm-mm. And gas prices. Should I going to be going up? That was the second question from
Dave. Dave says, should I trust my financial advisor? Well, that depends who it is. are they over the age of 40? So a lot of, it's a good question, Dave. And you asked a question there as well, if the CDs are spread across different banks. So very clearly, very quick, FDIC insurance works for a person or a couple, one account or multiple accounts at a bank. So whether you have one account or five accounts at a bank, that counts as one unit. So you could get $250,000 of protection for that. So if you had different banks, then you would have 250 at each one of those different banks. That's how that would work. It used to be 250 per account. That made my life a lot easier back in the day if you had such troubles, because you know, you could just spread across accounts.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, that's got to be, that's complicated.
Wealthy on today had Lance say to use use a brokerage account instead of a bank, because SIPC insurance for brokers is $100K in cash and $400K in equities, in addition to additional insurance up to $100 million or more. That additional insurance is for malfeasance. That SIPC insurance, though, again, that's an insurance scheme, so you'd have to look at that and understand that.
How deep
is that pool, right? If one brokerage went under, is the SIPC like barely dented, or did that just whole thing get wiped out? So you'd have to actually look at the depth of that. Because to say something is insured, the next question is, who's the insurance company, right? So insurance is great until you actually need it, you know, and then it becomes a nightmare. So yeah, that's tricky. Then you have to trust the insurance to actually pay it out. Yep. Right, Matt Doyle? Absolutely. Thea, Jordan, charcoal or chlorella? We're really jumping topics. Chlorella would have been the thing that Evie was talking about, but charcoal could maybe take it out too. But this is 2008 all over again, but with some different scenarios. So I do think we're coming into a deep financial panic. So look, all the recession indicators I have are screaming hot right now. So everything says we've got a huge decline in the housing and real estate markets. We have the 2-10s are inverted on the yield curve. We've got vast slowdowns in manufacturing. We've got all kinds of things going on. So Archangel says FDIC has 99 years to settle your claim.
Is that accurate?
The FDA is jealous.
Sounds
they
right.
They only had 75 years to try and release the data. Ella the Hippo here asking, why is no one mentioning that if you have your accounts at SVB signed up in the IntraFi network, that your account would be insured substantially more than $250,000 by FDIC by sweeping your deposits over multiple banks? So I have to learn more about that, but there are services out there. IntraFi, I believe, is one, and I think Morgan Stanley has one as well, that manages this risk for you and opens up multiple accounts for you and sweeps them and pushes them all over the place. So there is, that's a good point. There is a way to sort of manage that. The people I feel worse for are small and medium-sized businesses, because they have, often they are forced to keep all of their money at a single bank.
Right.
Right. Because if I'm a small business and I've got payroll, and I've got expenses coming in, and I've got bills going out, and all kinds of stuff, it's really difficult to manage that in $250,000 units across six banks. You know.
Yeah. You just.
It's
can't. Just.
It's impossible. So you get stuck, and you're in a single bank. But you should pay attention to your bank really, really carefully, and you should absolutely be watching that bank like a hawk, and you should be watching the bank stock, the bonds of that bank. Those should be little tickers at the first sign of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You do not ask questions. You immediately run. So the strategy for this is to make sure that you have multiple bank accounts in multiple banks, and they're all hooked up with some sort of electronic funds transfer. So if you have them EFT linked, you can move things relatively quickly as long as you don't have max limits on that would prevent you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and for people, I know everybody's in a different place financially. So for some people, it might apply. Some people, it might not. But I think it's super important just to stock up on food and other commodity products, because what happens, as we all know, what happened with, you know, supply chain disruptions and stuff like that during COVID was that once it got going, like something would be back in stock eventually, but then people just kept buying it out, you know, because there was that deficit or that lag. So when this hits sort of the world of retail and food and all of that, it might become an issue. So it's just a good idea to have that on hand. And we talk about that at Peak Prosperity. If you want to come back over to the website, there are lots of conversations about what people are doing, when they're doing it, how they're doing it, you know, what each person is willing to share about their own personal mm-hmm. situation. But people that are experts in that sense around finances and, you know, growing gardens and food preservation and all of that. And also about having a happy life, which is the most important part of it all.
Absolutely.
In my personal opinion.
Well, I was having this, I talked to a lot of people this weekend, and I got more phone calls as soon as we get off here because stuff's happening, right?
Yeah.
But I was just talking with Nick down in Georgia, and the question was, hey, what are you doing? And we're both really prepared. So I was kind of like, well, you know, Evie and I are like, well, we got some topping off to do here and there, you know, but we have our food stored, got our cash out of the bank, got the gold and silver, got this, got that. So we were both sort of nipping around the edges, and our conclusion was, you know what? We're okay. You know, we feel like good and comfortable around that. I don't know why more people don't approach it that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, I see some of you chatting and you're saying that, you know, I got friends, family, loved ones that who are not going to just don't understand this. And so I can't reach them. Well, they will be reached by reality, which will hit them like a salmon and cross the face at some point, and then they'll be interested, right? But then it's really hard to scramble and do things, you know. It just takes time to get ready, mentally ready, physically.
Well, I'd say
like
that's
that.
At just least half of it is just
time.
Getting wrapping your head around some of these things.
Yep.
Because it's not the world that we were taught about. It's just not.
Well, that doesn't fit. Scatterbolt saying keep the slide well oiled. Those two things don't go together. Have I ever read the Bitcoin Standard? No, I don't know what that is. The white paper I've taken a look at, but I don't know what the Bitcoin Standard is.
Add that to your list of books you need to get to.
Yeah. So at any rate, I should point out that for anybody listening, you know, I do serve on the board with the FLCCC, which is a bunch of fine, fine people. Pierre Corey, Paul Merrick, incredible staff. They are holding a conference for their donors April 27th that I'll be at. It's going to be really interesting because the topic of that is interesting. It's how to have impossible conversations.
That would be a good one.
So, yeah, it's an important conversation to have. So if anybody's listening to this and you want to come to that, you're a donor of the FLCCC, check your inbox because that'll be happening. Charles Eisenstein's going to be there. James Lindsay,
great.
Conceptual James, for those of you out on Twitter, but he co-wrote How to Have Impossible Conversations, the book, with Peter Boghossian.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter's just a wonderful, lovely guy. I haven't met James yet, but he seemed nice on a Zoom when I was talking with him. But Charles Eisenstein's going to be there. And the whole point is to figure out how to have these impossible conversations, because we got to reach these people. You know, mm-hmm. it's so painful to me to see these friends, families, colleagues, lovers, sons, fathers, daughters, you know, all getting separated
mm-hmm.
by this mental illness that's going on and infecting people, where we're talking about stuff that's totally irrelevant. Well, are you making money off of this? Like, we're talking about the wrong things in the wrong order, right?
That's
it's
a really
crazy
good point.
Making.
It is crazy making.
It totally is. So if anybody's interested in that, you should come to that because it's going to be phenomenal. Very intimate, and you'll get to meet all...
Threesome?
All those... Yeah.
Sorry. I couldn't help it.
it's an octosome. It's going to be a lot of folks. Well, with that, thank you very much for being here, everybody. We've got to bring this live cast to a close because Evie and I have a bunch of things we've got to do. I got some phone calls to make. So,
keep boiling sap.
Loved chatting with everybody here. It's fantastic. Those of you who are at Peak Prosperity, come on by. We're having we're still discussing our webinar from last night. It's a very active chat going on over there right now, and people are discussing it.
And one last thing, please, if you don't mind, like and share this and subscribe if you're not already subscribed, because that helps us get push through the algorithms and gets Chris's information served to more people. So we'd appreciate it if you
just
could
need
to
take the mouse, just push it over to the side. Okay. Click like. It's very easy. Not asking much. we're dangerously close to cracking the 500,000 subscriber mark on this channel, which apparently launches the algorithm we get into a new territory orbit. We're over 498, 498,000. So
cool. All
you beautiful, wonderful followers, thank you. And subscribers, thank you, thank you. And together we can get this done. So we got to get to common knowledge. And this will change quick once we can get people to wake up and see what's actually happening. And that'll be great because we don't have any more time to fool around in this story. We just don't. We got to get serious, get busy, have possible conversations, impossible conversations. Got to make it happen. Mm-hmm. So with that, thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Evie. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Mike. See everybody later. Bye-bye.
Pleasure.